Welcome to this second autoimmunity podcast focusing on celiac disease. My name is Emma Nash and I'm a GP in Hampshire and also part of the CPD team for the RCGP. May I introduce Charlie Andrews, who is a GP in Clevedon near Bristol. He's a committee member of the Primary Care Society of Gastroenterology and champion for West of England for inflammatory bowel disease. He's got a keen interest in gastroenterology and spends part of his working week at his local hospital learning endoscopy. In the first celiac podcast, we gave you an overview of celiac disease, from its presentation to its management. One of the key issues with celiac is that it's often undiagnosed or misdiagnosed, with around 70% of sufferers having no formal diagnosis. In this podcast, we're going to look at how we can improve the detection, including some of the more unusual presentations that you may not have considered. So, Charlie, let's start with talking about the most common situations where celiac disease may be missed. Can you give us an overview of some of the quick wins in diagnosis?
Firstly, Emma, it's quite obvious that in celiac disease there aren't really any easy wins. From my own experience and talking to colleagues, we do a lot of celiac blood tests and frequently they come back negative. However, there are certain circumstances where celiac disease is more common, and I'm just going to go through three scenarios where testing for celiac disease will have a higher yield. So firstly, patients with IBS type symptoms. So IBS type symptoms are present in about half of people with celiac disease. It's usually of the diarrheal type, and this is partly because fats are very poorly absorbed in people with celiac disease. So whilst we know that IBS type symptoms are a rich vein to mine when it comes to detecting celiac disease, we also know that a large number of people with IBS type symptoms are not tested for celiac disease, despite NICE suggesting that we should be doing this. So a large primary care study reported that about 25% of people who were eventually diagnosed with celiac disease had previously carried a diagnosis of IBS. So it's important to remember, as a primary care clinician, that it's not really possible to make a positive diagnosis of IBS without having tested for or at least considered celiac disease. So the second group is patients with anemia. So anemia is the second commonest presentation and it occurs in about 15% of those at diagnosis. Iron deficiency anemia is the commonest form of anemia. However, some patients may have folate or B12 deficiency. Those with iron deficiency anemia are a relatively high yield group for celiac disease. And so in all patients with iron deficiency anemia, the diagnosis of celiac disease should at least be considered, if not tested for. The British Society of Gastroenterology advises that in people with iron deficiency anemia, the pre-test probability of celiac disease is 5%. And so those referred via a two-week wait pathway, they really should have celiac testing carried out, preferably before endoscopy via a blood test. But if this hasn't been done, then they will normally do duodenal biopsies at the time of endoscopy. The third group where the yield is higher is high-risk groups. And by high-risk groups, I mean patients where we know there is a higher genetic susceptibility for having celiac disease. So, for example, people with a first-degree relative with celiac disease have a 10% chance of developing celiac disease. So this is a group where we should certainly be testing. Secondly, other autoimmune conditions. So for example, patients with type 1 diabetes or autoimmune thyroiditis, these patients are more likely to have celiac disease as well. So somewhere in the region of 8% with type 1 diabetes. So again, we should be considering testing for celiac disease in these patients. And actually, NICE guidance does reflect this and asks us that we do test in these patient groups. This really emphasizes the importance of asking about family history and also using a knowledge of that patient's medical history to guide our clinical decision making.
So clinical staff and many of the public know that celiac disease affects the gut, but many are less aware that it can cause problems in other body systems. Which body systems do you think we should be most vigilant for the possibility of celiac disease in?
So I'm going to answer this in a slightly roundabout way, because actually I feel that understanding the pathophysiology of celiac disease really helps to understand why people develop the symptoms that they do, and actually why this is not just a condition affecting the bowel, but actually affecting multiple systems in the body. So it might sound like a bit of a digression, but actually I feel that it is really helpful to know. So what I'm going to do is just talk through what happens in a celiac patient's body when they consume a gluten-containing food. So for example, let's take a patient with celiac disease and see what happens when they eat a, you know, a gluten-rich croissant, for example. Just before I do that, though, I am going to digress slightly and just explain that gluten is a storage protein, and it's found in many different grasses, such as wheat, barley, and rye. And the reason for gluten, or not the reason, but one of the things that we harness gluten for is giving bread and baked goods that sort of nice, chewy, airy texture. So that's what gluten is. So it's found in those grasses, particularly wheat, barley, and rye. So if we look at what's going on within the body, so the croissant is eaten. It enters the stomach before it moves into the small bowel. So at the frond-like brush border of the small bowel, the gluten is absorbed through the mucosa of the bowel. And here it meets tissue transglutaminase. Tissue transglutaminase is an enzyme that breaks down the gluten into various peptides. And these gluten peptides are then presented to the body's immune system. This is done through an intermediary, as it were, which in the case of celiac disease is HLA, or human leukocyte antigen, DQ2 and DQ8. So this HLA is a surface protein which is found on the walls of cells of the immune system and is really important for detecting self from antigen and activating the immune system in response when appropriate. So in celiac disease, these HLA subtypes, which incidentally are found in almost all patients with celiac disease, activate both the innate and the adaptive immune system to kick off an immune response in response to consuming gluten. So gluten is, in a sense, acting as an antigen and activating our immune system. So it does a couple of things here. So it activates our innate immune system, which leads to an inflammatory process within the mucosa of the small bowel, which leads to the development of flattened villi and the loss of that normal frond-like appearance of the small bowel, which in healthy people is so well adapted to absorbing nutrients from the food that we eat. At the same time, it's also activating our adaptive immune system, and this leads to the development of antibodies against gluten and various aspects of its absorption and processing, such as tissue transglutaminase. These antibodies can then enter the bloodstream, and this forms one of our early tests for celiac disease, so we can detect antibodies to tissue transglutaminase, for example. But these antibodies can also do other things. So these circulating antibodies can cause clinical signs and symptoms far distant from the GI tract. And this is what turns celiac disease into not only a gut condition, but actually a multi-system autoimmune disease. So from that, it's obvious that someone with celiac disease may well develop gut symptoms. And yes, we do find this in about 50% of patients. However, quite a number of patients don't have any gastrointestinal symptoms at all, but could have features of, for example, malabsorption, such as malabsorption of calcium, which could lead to osteoporosis in more severe cases, iron, B12 and folate malabsorption, and also difficulties absorbing fat-soluble vitamins, such as vitamins A, D, E and K. Now, beyond the gut, I find this part fascinating. It's fascinating that circulating antibodies to gluten and tissue transglutaminase can cause, in some people with celiac disease, a broad range of problems in other body systems. So, for example, in the skin, these antibodies can trigger the development of dermatitis herpetiformis. In the brain, they may lead to ataxia, and they've also been implicated in fertility. And these antibodies can also lead to splenic dysfunction. So splenic dysfunction is believed to be present in about a third of patients at diagnosis with celiac disease. And this is really important because it puts them at quite a high risk of recurrent and severe infections. And this is why we advocate that celiacs should have annual flu vaccination and the pneumococcal vaccine. So really, as you can see, Emma, celiac disease should be considered a multi-system disorder rather than just a gastrointestinal condition. And we need to really have it on our radar for such a wide range of presentations, even in those who don't have any bowel-related symptoms.
Thanks, Charlie. I think many people didn't realise it was quite as complex as that. So in that case then, could you give me a clue about skin? You spoke about dermatitis herpetiformis. Don't think everybody's necessarily sure what that looks like. So what would it that would be prompt us to check for celiac disease?
So dermatitis herpetiformis occurs in about 15 to 25% of people with celiac disease. So whilst not all people with celiac disease will develop dermatitis herpetiformis, on the other side of the coin, almost all patients who develop dermatitis herpetiformis will have celiac disease, whether they have other features of it or not. In fact, very few people with dermatitis herpetiformis will have kind of the overt symptoms of gastrointestinal involvement. So it may be the only sign of celiac disease. And why does it develop? Well, it's caused by a presence of IgA antibodies. And remember, IgA antibodies are usually found on mucous membranes rather than within the skin. And these antibodies can cause an immunological response beneath the skin. And this leads to, well, the classical features in dermatitis herpetiformis of clusters of intensely itchy blisters. And it has an appearance, a herpetic appearance, hence the name. The commoner sites for this would be on the extensor surfaces of the elbows and the knees. However, it can occur in multiple other areas, such as the buttocks and the scalp. And the diagnosis of dermatitis herpetiformis is made by a skin biopsy, where they find deposits of IgA in the subdermal layers next to the lesions. If you suspect dermatitis herpetiformis, you need to be doing two things, really. So firstly, we need to be confirming the diagnosis via a dermatologist, and dermatologists will like to take a skin biopsy to confirm that this is the condition, and sometimes they will treat with things like Dapsone. At the same time, you should really be considering referrals to gastroenterology, because as I've said, it's so closely linked with gluten sensitivity and with celiac disease that we really need to be getting a diagnosis if that is the case. And we know also that the features of dermatitis herpetiformis very much fluctuate with gluten ingestion. And so a strict gluten-free diet really does help to resolve the condition.
So let's look next at neurological presentations. What are your thoughts there?
This is a really interesting area and one where our knowledge is growing. But at this stage, you know, we don't know the full ins and outs of why people will develop this. So there were case reports since the 1970s of people developing neurological symptoms, in particular ataxia, in relation to celiac disease. But it wasn't actually until about the late 1990s that a team from Sheffield systematically looked at this link. And what they did was they took a group of patients with idiopathic ataxia from a neurological clinic, and they assessed them for evidence of gluten sensitivity. And they were very surprised to find that actually almost half of these patients tested positive for antibodies that we generally find in association with celiac disease. They also carried out some endoscopic investigation of these patients and found that a large number of them also had what we would sort of describe as silent celiac disease, so perhaps no other symptoms apart from this neurological side. So they found in this group that lower limb ataxia and nystagmus, as well as gait ataxia, were the more common features. And the condition was called gluten ataxia in order to reflect the fact that gluten was a significant part of the driver behind the condition. Neuroimaging for these patients also showed in some cerebellar atrophy, which improved on following a strictly gluten-free diet. However, not everyone showed significant improvements with the gluten-free diet. So there is an understanding that actually neurological symptoms from celiac disease may well be permanent. So it's really important that this is picked up early and treated with a gluten-free diet to prevent long-term sequelae from occurring. So why do people develop neurological symptoms? The current research suggests that there is an immunological basis for this, with cross-reactivity occurring between antibodies to, for example, tissue transglutaminase and certain aspects of the nervous system, such as Purkinje fibers. And so this accounts for why some people are developing gluten ataxia, but also other neurological problems, such as peripheral neuropathy. Both of these symptoms are are reflected in the NICE guidelines, and they suggest that if we have a patient with unexplained ataxia or peripheral neuropathy, we should be considering celiac testing in these patients.
Great, okay, so I understand that it can also cause problems in pregnancy. How does this work?
So it's being increasingly recognised that there seems to be a link between celiac disease and fertility problems. Across a number of studies which have looked at cases of unexplained infertility, celiac disease has been detected in up to 8% of cases. And in most of these have been patients who have been completely asymptomatic of celiac disease, so have had no gastrointestinal symptoms at all. It's been suggested that celiac disease can also lead to adverse outcomes in pregnancy. However, the evidence from these studies seems to be a little bit ambiguous at the moment, so it's not a strong link there. The most commonly encountered fertility and pregnancy-related problems found in those with celiac disease are recurrent miscarriage, which is defined as two or more miscarriages concurrently, preterm labour, and intrauterine growth restriction. It's also been suggested that delayed menarche and premature menopause caused by celiac disease could restrict a woman's fertility further. Now, nutritional factors such as malabsorption of, for example, folate may impact on fertility, but so too may immunological factors, as it's been found that in those who have got no nutritional deficiency, there are still sometimes issues with fertility. And circulating antibodies of tissue transglutaminase have actually been implicated by some researchers. So, for example, tissue transglutaminase is found ubiquitously around the body and has been found in placental tissue. And so circulation of antibodies to this may lead to problems with placental implantation early in pregnancy. The NICE guidelines recommends that we should consider celiac disease in those with unexplained fertility or recurrent miscarriages. And it's really important that we do this, because actually we know that the delayed diagnosis is around 10 years for celiac disease. And you can imagine this could have a significant impact on someone's ability to have a family, for example.
So celiac disease is quite clearly a multi-system disorder with lots of potential symptoms. But I understand that patients don't always report symptoms. So what lab results might suggest that celiac disease should be considered?
We should be really alert to celiac disease in those who have blood tests which are showing malabsorption of certain nutrients. For example, as I mentioned before, iron, folate and B12 deficiency, but also in those with hypocalcemia. So we should be considering it in that group of patients. You know, that could be the only sign of celiac disease in a patient, for example. You know, someone who's got no GI symptoms at all may simply have features of malabsorption. Aside from these findings of malabsorption on blood results, we should also consider those who have abnormal liver function tests, as about 1 in 10 celiacs will have abnormal liver function tests at diagnosis. And by abnormal liver function tests, I'm generally talking about a slightly raised ALT, which is completely reversible on starting a gluten-free diet. So again, NICE reflects this, and the guidelines suggest that in those with persistently raised liver enzymes, we should be considering celiac disease, amongst obviously a number of other conditions.
So we talked a bit about tests that might give us a clue as to celiacs there. What tests should we be doing in terms of making the diagnosis? And if we get a negative result on one of these tests, what do we do if we're pretty sure that someone still has it?
Sure. So the main blood test used to diagnose celiac disease is a test for tissue transglutaminase antibodies. And if we reflect back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of how celiac disease develops, you can understand why that's quite an important antibody to pick up. The test has a sensitivity and specificity of about 95% for celiac disease, so it is a very, very good test. In areas where that test isn't available, we could also use anti-endomysial antibodies. So this is another test that could be used. So in the event of a negative test result, but ongoing suspicion for celiac disease, which I think is part of what you were asking there, it's important to rule out false negative results. That's probably the first thing you want to be doing. And really, to try to avoid false negatives, we should be thinking about counselling patients before doing the test around certain things. So firstly, we should ask ourselves, was the patient consuming gluten prior to doing the test? So prior to doing the test, we should be advising patients that they should eat gluten-containing foods twice daily for at least 6 weeks. That's obviously quite difficult because a number of patients will have altered their diet on the belief that, it is gluten that's causing their symptoms. So in some situations, you might have to say to patients, look, you need to start consuming gluten so that we can do the tests. Otherwise, we may well miss the diagnosis here. So that's the first thing that we really need to do. And that's a really important message. The second thing we want to ask ourselves is, are they IgA deficient? So both tissue transglutaminase and anti-endomysial testing relies on the presence of normal levels of immunoglobulin A. IgA deficiency is 10 times commoner in people with celiac disease than the general population, and it's found in about 2% of celiac patients. So in those who are IgA deficient, we should be testing for IgG tissue transglutaminase instead. Some labs will be testing automatically for IgA alongside, for example, IgA tissue transglutaminase antibodies. So you may well get that full package done at your lab, but it might be worth just checking whether that is the case, because that could be a cause of a false negative. Now, if you do have a patient where you've gone through this process and they are still, as we'd sort of say, antibody negative, but you're still really suspicious of celiac disease, then I think a referral to a gastroenterologist would be very reasonable to try to pick apart whether this is celiac disease or not.
So whilst we're on the topic of diagnosis of celiac disease, I just want to draw your attention to a new guidance that's been brought out by the British Society of Gastroenterology, which is for a pathway which does not require a biopsy to make the diagnosis of celiac disease. So prior to coronavirus, we've generally seen the duodenal biopsy as the gold standard for the diagnosis of celiac disease. However, given the challenges that coronavirus has been presenting, the British Society of Gastroenterology have formulated a pathway that in some patients will negate the need for a biopsy. For example, some patients may be able to be diagnosed on the basis of blood tests alone, and those would be the blood tests that we've already talked about. So the tissue transglutaminase antibody and also the anti-endomysial antibody test. So there are a group of people who may be suitable for that. I'd advise you to have a look at their website. So if you look up British Society of Gastroenterology guidance, you'll be able to see this pathway if you look for celiac disease. So you could have a look at that. It's too early at the moment to know how much this will affect what we do in primary care, but I think it's worth being aware that this change may be on the horizon. And knowing what arrangements are being put in place in your local area is going to be really important. So I would recommend that you're aware of what's going on centrally through the British Society of Gastroenterology, but I'd also make sure that you're aware of what's going on locally in your area with regards to the diagnosis of celiac disease at this time.
Okay, so far we've focused on adults, but how common is it in babies and children, and what might prompt us to test for celiac disease in them?
Well, celiac disease in the past used to be viewed as a paediatric condition, really. So if we go back 50 to 100 years, this was mainly a condition that was seen in children, but we now know that the average age of diagnosis is 45, actually. That being said, you know, not insignificant number of patients will be diagnosed below that age. And so a childhood diagnosis is not actually that uncommon. So children can present with, you know, the range of symptoms that we see in adults, from IBS type symptoms to iron deficiency anemia and everything in between. In children, diarrhea again is found in about half of children, whereas abdominal pain is actually really common in children with celiac disease. So about 90% will have abdominal pain. However, as I'm sure you probably appreciate, abdominal pain is quite a common finding in children. So this isn't always a particularly discriminating marker for celiac disease. So if we look at, and we're considering diagnosis of celiac disease in children, we can kind of separate them into a younger and an older age group. In the younger age group, faltering growth might be an indicator of the disease and should prompt us to test for celiac disease, obviously amongst a number of other things. In this younger age group, you know, a pattern that might be encountered is a child who is fully well until the point of weaning, at which point gluten-containing foods were introduced into the diet, and then at that point, their weight starts to falter. If we look at a slightly older age group, perhaps adolescents, for example, we should really consider celiac disease in those who've got, for example, delayed puberty, delayed menarche, short stature, alongside, you know, the broad range of symptoms that we find in adult populations.
So obviously it's pretty clear, and we've discussed about how we go about testing in adults. Is it the same process in children?
So the diagnostic process is pretty similar, but there are a few differences in children. Under the age of two, tissue transglutaminase antibodies are not a reliable marker of this disease. And so in that sort of age group, secondary care referral and assessment would be appropriate. Above that age, tissue transglutaminase antibodies can be more supportive of a diagnosis. And so a positive result should really prompt a referral to secondary care, as you would in adults. It's at that point that the process differs slightly. So, for example, endoscopic confirmation of celiac disease is absolutely essential in adults. However, in children, it's not always necessary. So, for example, some children where there is a combination of positive tissue transglutaminase antibodies, anti-endomysial antibodies, as well as positivity for HLA-DQ2 and DQ8, may be sufficient to make a positive diagnosis of celiac disease without an endoscopy. Obviously, that's all being done in secondary care, so we wouldn't be doing that in primary care, but that's one of the differences.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Charlie, for this really informative discussion. And we've covered a lot of information here, which I'm sure that plenty of people will find really helpful. So if you'd like to know more about celiac disease and other autoimmune conditions, there are more resources on these within the Autoimmunity Hub and also on the RCGP online learning environment.